is great when Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, one of the most influential people on the political scene in the country today, takes the time to join me on the John Carlson Show. Hello, Grover. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm doing quite well. Life is cheerful.
I'm glad to hear that, and I expect, by the way, we could talk about 8 or 9 different things. I want to get a quick review from you about how the political scene looks, both in terms of the primary and in terms of the general election in November.
Well, here's the good news. We are on the Reagan Republican conservative side, nominating congressmen and senators who are both solid Reagan Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, and competent and electable. You know, back in 2010, we had some eager beavers who ran against, because nobody else thought there was going to be a reason to think there was an earthquake coming, ran against more perhaps establishment candidates who had been in office perhaps too long, won primaries, but weren't positioned to win the general.
Yeah, probably cost us 4 seats, I'm thinking. Four Senate races that went the other way.
Yes, and partly that was because people who could have run, I mean, you know, there were other Reagan Republicans who didn't take the risk to challenge an incumbent because that's life's unsure. And so some of the people who did were quite good and quite wonderful. Lee in Utah has been a great asset, and Rubio
and Cruz
and so on. But, you know, there were some great guys who primaried. And then there were some others who kind of were accidental candidates as people were shifting older, big-spending Republicans out and not doing the right job interview for the guy coming in.
Right.
A complete job interview.
Right. Probably lost a chance in Nevada. Missouri.
Colorado,
Missouri. But this year, the Tea Party people who are winning are, I think, inherently very electable. I love this Ben Sass in Nebraska. And tell me about what we have going on in Mississippi.
Mississippi, there's an interesting race. There you have McDaniels is the state legislator challenging Cochran. Cochran is older. He's been an appropriator, and I think is Mississippi is a state where either one of them should win in the general. I worry a little bit only because I don't know that a guy who is and who am I speaking to, a radio talk show for years and years,
yes,
may have stuff that the opposition research guys can play with. Mm-hmm. But I think either of them should win in the general. And
The problem with Thad Cochran, I mean, I remember being a huge fan of his because he was one of the first Republicans to win in the Deep South. And it was back in 1978 he won that Senate seat.
Yeah.
And, you know, 78 was 35 years ago. Thad, it's time to hang it up. And, you know, I hadn't seen him in years, and I, you know, saw some pictures and some video of him, and I'm going, oh, no, one term too many, my friend.
Well, and when we were having a conversation about some of the up-and-coming, quote-unquote, Tea Party guys who were perhaps not the strongest candidates in the world, that happens both at the beginning of a career and at the end of a career. Thad Cochran has not run a real primary or real general since he first got elected. So he's almost like the sort of newbie candidate who jumps out well-meaning but doesn't really know how to campaign in the general. So I think there's some real challenges there. My objections to Mr. Cochran's history is that he became an appropriator.
Yeah.
And there are, in fact, 3 political parties in Washington, D.C. It's a joke people here tell, but it's funny because it's true. And that is there's a Republican Party, a Democratic Party, and the appropriators. And sometimes appropriators wear a Republican jersey and sometimes wear a Democratic jersey, but they always have a big S for spending on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And we've made some real progress, and this was a Tea Party success, on demonizing earmarks.
Yeah.
3 years ago, bringing earmarks, bringing bacon, the pork, back to your district was a sign of manliness. It was a sign of how powerful and important you were in Washington, D.C. Now it's the equivalent of smoking at the dinner table, you know, it's and shoplifting.
Right.
You don't brag about it, even if you do it.
Yeah, no, that's a very good analysis, Grover. That used to be said, well, I'm bringing home the bacon for the home folks. It's what they sent me back there to do, is, you know, bring money back. And now it's being seen as you're making the debt worse.
Yeah. One of the things I always liked about Boehner, the Republican speaker, who takes some flack because he can't pass legislation in the Senate and get the president to sign it, which is not quite his job description.
And when you're in the House.
Yeah. But when you only have the House, you know, if all you have is a hammer, if everything's a nail, if you only have the House, you want the House to do everything. But Boehner never, ever did earmarks before that was viewed as problematic. And that was a real interesting issue. I had a very conservative congressman friend from California who showed up here and he said, I can't believe it. I had no idea my job description was to take phone calls from mayors and local elected officials and fill out reports urging them to get their grants from the federal government. That they had that relationship with the previous Republican congressman. They assumed to have it. And if congressmen don't do earmarks, it frees up time for them to actually govern.
Right. Exactly. No, very, again, very astute analysis. It would be nice if earmarks in this country just became part of the memory bank, just went away as a way of passing budgets. All right. Now, I want to ask you about a couple other things. First of all, I've got to ask you about the situation in Arizona. It's utterly surreal. The Department of Homeland Security is supposed to safeguard the border and keep people who are not supposed to be here out, or is actually supposed to send them home after the Border Patrol captures them. Instead, inspired in large part by the DREAM Act, which apparently a lot of them didn't read in detail, Grover, you've got tens of thousands of juveniles from Central American countries along in Mexico of streaming into the United States. They don't know what to do with them. Obviously, they don't want to just turn around and say, no, go home. So they're trying to accommodate them, and they're busing them into Nogales, Arizona. And they tell the governor, we're going to keep busing them because we don't have places to put them here in Texas. What would you do about this problem?
Oh, dear. Look, it's a mess, and I can't even begin to guess what makes sense. As you say, the concept of the DREAM Act is people who were brought here by parents when they were 4 years old and are now graduating from high school, you know, are Americans, for crying out loud. They speak English, maybe not Spanish. And is there something, do we recognize there's a difference between being a four-year-old who's brought over, your parents came over illegally, are you culpable for that? You know, probably not at age four.
And I think it's before 2007, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there's a cutoff. It's specifically designed to not encourage this sort of behavior. But again, that's not necessarily the way it gets translated, and it would probably pay for the United States government to yell down at our friends in the southern border and say, and have your ambassador get on the TV and say, let me just explain this to you in Spanish, what it is. You don't have to yell at anybody. They would love to interview the ambassador to Venezuela or Mexico. Get on the TV and talk. But the administration is too busy dealing with its other foreign policy failures. So I don't know that there's a lot of adult supervision going on.
Real quickly, one of the things that you're doing is flagging for people that a Obamacare tax is about to hit millions of Americans, and they might not even know it.
The Congressional Budget Office put out a statement that says 4 million people are expected to voluntarily report that they chose not to join Obamacare and be subject to the tax. Now, the way they wrote it is kind of many are expected to voluntarily report on their tax returns that they are uninsured and to pay the amount owed. Okay? By the way, this is a legal requirement. This is not something that's your choice. But what they're saying there is they think 4 million people will report on their tax form that they owe the tax penalty for not buying into Obamacare and pay it. We do not know how many others will owe that money. And therefore, in the future, next year, if you owe the Obamacare tax, and you do remember
that
we were promised
1% of your salary.
Yes, we were told again and again that no one making less than $250,000 under Barack Obama's plan will see one single penny of their tax raised, whether it's capital gains tax, their income tax, or investment tax, any tax, says
right,
you know, says our friend Mr. Obama during the campaign. Now, of course, 4 million Americans, most of them middle and lower income Americans, are going to owe this. At least 4 million they think will pay it. More, and they don't tell us how many more will owe it. They will discover, a lot of people are going to discover, that their refund checks in 2015 are not what they thought for one of two reasons. Either they didn't report that they owed this money, and therefore the government takes it out of their refund, or they got more of a subsidy. If they went into Obamacare and they got a subsidy, the government looks back and says, well, we think we gave you too much of a subsidy. Or maybe you misstated your income to get the subsidy. Or maybe you accurately stated your income when you filled out the paperwork, but your income went up. So millions of Americans are going to end up hit with tax clawbacks, not just the tax for not signing up for Obamacare. But if you do sign up for Obamacare, you could discover that, in fact, you've been oversubsidized and the government wants its money back. They promise not to put you in jail for failing to pay the Obamacare tax. They make no such promises if you forget to pay up when they tell you that they oversubsidized you.
By the way,
you.
keep your eye on this, Grover. The Obama administration boasted that 8 million Americans had signed up for health care on the Obamacare exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after 90 days, if you haven't paid your premium, you know, if you've gone missing now for 3 months and you haven't paid a bill, they're supposed to drop you. And they are not reporting out how many people they're dropping because they didn't pay their bill.
Which means it's not four.
Yeah, that's my point, yes.
If it was a small number, you would know it.
Right. Right. If it was a small number. Hey, hardly anyone has been dropped because everybody, you know, the vast majority of Americans. So of the people, and they stopped doing monthly reports on how many Americans have signed up. But now if people don't pay their premiums because they were counting people as signed up even if they hadn't paid, which is interesting because when I buy something from the store, they kind of wait until they have a payment, a form of payment in hand before I'm called a customer.
Yes. Just because you put it in the shopping basket on Amazon.
Right.
Doesn't mean that you bought it.
It's when
they don't borrow money based on how many people thought about something.
If the transaction is at the cash register, not when I place something in the shopping basket. That's absolutely correct. So I would love to know what those numbers are, but they're not letting it out. Okay, last thing I got to ask you here, and then I know it's a busy day for you. You wrote a piece a year ago, why Republicans should never raise taxes, and you were Churchilling about this. Never, ever, ever, ever should Republicans vote to raise taxes. Is there any exception you would make to that rule?
No, because raising taxes is what politicians do instead of governing. Raising taxes is what they do instead of making decisions, instead of prioritizing, instead of saying this is more important and we're going to do it and we'll do more of it, and this is less important and we're going to do less of it or none of it. Tax increases are by definition what you do instead of making the hard decisions that we elect people to, Washington or the state legislature or city council, to say how do we do this and how do we govern? How do we reform government so that it costs less and is more effective? Tax increases are not just damaging to the economy. It's that they're done instead of important decisions.
Which is why I wanted to close by asking you to post either on the ATR.org, that's Americans for Tax Reform, ATR.org website, or rerun in National Review your essay, Why Republicans Should Never Raise Taxes. It's a perennial. It's something that should resurface every year
or so. Well, thank you. We certainly shall. And on our website, ATR.org, you can always see the list of who's made the commitment never to raise taxes in writing by taking the taxpayer protection pledge.
Excellent. Always great hearing your voice, Grover. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning on KVI.
Hey, John. Thank you.
You got it. That's Grover Norquist joining us here at Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 10 minutes to 7 o'clock, and in the next 8 minutes, I'm going to give away another American flag.